Group meeting, Saturday, 22nd June, 1985. So now we come to chapter 2. Immediately the question arises, can the heart of religion be communicated through the medium of thought or speech? As long as we are self-conscious, we are as opaque matter obstructing the light. When we are reduced to our nothingness, the transcendent is there. Now, I have said, as long as we are self-conscious, we are as opaque matter obstructing the light. Self-consciousness is not the flaw. The organism must of necessity have self-consciousness, otherwise it couldn't possibly live at all, even unwisely, leave alone perfectly or wisely in the world of manifestation. So self-consciousness we have to have. We can't even cross the street safely unless we were self-conscious. We might, without self-consciousness, we might walk into the middle of the road and meet a bus. We might dent the bus a little bit, but we ourselves would be hurt very much more. That way. What the trouble with self-consciousness is just this, that it is isolative, it is separative. We have not developed that far within ourselves to realize that what we call the other thing or person is very intimately and completely interrelated with us. And it interacts with us all the time. The whole universe is a universe in which complete interaction takes place because of total interrelationship. But we human beings, who are conscious human beings, are not awake to that fact. Science has shown us the interrelationship, that the interrelationship is complete. Science has come to that point. But we humans are not conscious of that fact. We may read about it, we may hear about it, and we may even believe it, but belief as belief is impotent. When the belief we hold or the idea we express is something of which we are actually conscious in ourselves, then that consciousness inevitably and naturally and spontaneously expresses itself through all our thinking, feeling, speaking and doing. This is the great difference. That is why the awakening of consciousness is so important. Now, I am using a phrase which all the great religious teachings and the mystics have used, when we are reduced to our nothingness. If you look at it this way, to our no-thingness. We are conscious of ourselves in the fashion in which we are conscious of objects, things. We are a thing, each one of us. But when we transcend this limited consciousness of thinghood, then we'll realize that the ultimate reality, which is the no thing, but the transcendence, is what we actually are. So when we are reduced to our nothingness consciously, then the transcendent is here. I've written there, but there meaning here, in us. In this experiencing the infinite, we are unself-conscious. That is to say, we are not conscious in isolative and separative terms. We are at one with everything and with everybody. And this, when, for instance, the Buddha taught compassion and so forth, you see, and when Jesus spoke about love, that was the meaning implied. There is no such thing as the other. It is there simply because we are conscious through the activity of our senses, the functioning of our senses, and the interpretation by the brain. And our brains are heavily conditioned right from birth onwards. So that everything is other. You, he, she, it, dog, house, etc., etc. Everything is other than me. Because we are conscious in this limited way, we behave as if everything was other. But everything is completely interrelated. It is not other, but we are not conscious of it. That is the root trouble. So you get the great dualism, self, not self. This little thing with its short life is the self. Everything else is the not self. The whole cosmos. And in our awareness of ourself and our behavior with respect to ourself and with respect to our environment, the self is supremely important. The rest of the cosmos, well, it is there. I must do the best and get the best out of it. How rarely does a person think or work in terms of, I will give the best unto it? How rarely? See, it is a matter of this limited consciousness. No blame attached anywhere. This is how it is. This is how the evolutionary process brings about that progress and development in us, the whole organism, by which we become conscious of transcendence. We do not know God, but God knows us. We cannot know God, for our kind of knowing is incapable of grasping the infinite. The knowing by the infinite of us is other than what we can mentally perceive. The way you can use the word transcendence or God or Allah or whichever you like, or ultimate reality if you like, the way the ultimate reality knows us is something which we cannot grasp mentally. You know, for instance, the man who is master of his subject, say a professor of mathematics or something. What is in his mind, he tries to present to the class, to the beginners, so to say. Now the beginners get an idea or a few ideas about what they are being taught, but what is in their mind is never comparable to what is in the mind of the professor. He is the perfect one. It's like that. The beloved who truly gives herself to love swoons. The lover knows her. Now, you know, in Genesis chapter 4, the first verse, and Adam knew his wife Eve, and she conceived. Now, of course, everybody interprets that in the usual biological way. But this knowing and this conceiving is something utterly different from what we mortals in the ordinary sense understand. when you give yourself totally, unreservedly, unconditionally to that which is the ultimate source, you swoon, that is to say, you are unconscious of self. When you faint or are knocked unconscious, you become unconscious of yourself, don't you? You don't know I am I. You can no more be aware I am I. You have swooned. Now, when this total giving to ultimate truth, or whatever you like to call it, takes place, you swoon. And the ultimate reality, the truth, transcendence, God, knows you. That knowing brings about a conception. What is a conception? Con, together with, and capio, capere, I capture, I take unto myself. That is the sort of transcendental meaning of conception. Now, biologically, the woman conceives. She has a conception with marital relationships. You see, she has captured that which creates new life. That is its sort of first matter-of-fact meaning. And Adam knew his wife Eve, and she conceived. Truly experiencing, recovering from the swoon, which is the unself-conscious state, a conception grows because the natural tendency of the surface mind, the conscious verbalizer. Now I'm using the word conception in the ordinary everyday meaning, having a thought, an idea, a thought form, a logical sequential presentation of what has happened, you see. A conception grows because the natural tendency of the surface mind, the conscious verbalizer, is to set limits to the infinite and formulate a spatio-temporal experience out of the spaceless and timeless experiencing. The actual experiencing is spaceless and timeless. Therefore, it is immeasurable. Therefore, it is utterly stainless. It can never go wrong. It is the ultimate truth, the ultimate rightness. Strange are the results of such conceiving. That now I'm using the word conceiving in our ordinary mortal sense, working out a system of thought and philosophy and whatnot, and theology, you see. Truly experiencing the immeasurable is indescribable. The unknown, the infinite, cannot be crammed into the known and finite mold of thought speech. Thinking, speaking about the transcendent only forges mental images of the imageless. We make so many mental images about it. All our theologies and philosophies are, as I have said later on in another chapter, cloud palaces of thought. A game of make-believe, like the fantasy play of an imaginative child. The living experiencing is truth in the religious sense. It is the real knowing of God. You know how it is said of St. Thomas Aquinas, after he finished the first 12 books of his Summa Theologiae, or theologica, some people say. He started writing the 13th, and then he stopped. He never completed the Summa Theologiae. A friend asked him why, an intimate friend of his, and he divulged the fact that he, whilst proceeding with that 13th volume, had the vision of the reality. He had become one with that transcendence in consciousness. And therefore he stopped, because, as he told his friend, all that I've written about all this is rubbish. He used the word rubbish. Now, if St. Thomas Aquinas could do that, who are we to talk about transcendence and so on? It's very, very significant. The images made by the mind, the verbal formulations set down in a book, even in holy writ, however stimulating or inspiring, are but expressions of conceiving and bringing forth, this is in thought and speech, excrescences which are excrescences of the ineffable reality. All manifestation is a throwing out of itself. All existence, therefore, is a standing out of the supreme truth, the supreme reality. Exist. Ex sistere. Sistere, to stand. Ex out of. You stand out of the absolute. And therefore you exist. And all these stimulating and inspiring expressions of conceiving are only a tomb of the truth. Man, the living immortal, now I'm talking of man as the perfect man, through whom transcendence realizes its own transcendence as humanity. Man, the living immortal, must rise out of this tomb, leaving in it merely a bundle of clothes, an astonishment to the unawakened. Now understand the two Marys going into the tomb of Jesus and finding only a bundle of clothes and no body. You see, the body Jesus symbolically represents the concretized ultimate truth, ultimate reality. The clothes represent the teachings, the writings, and so forth. Notice how significant it is that when Jesus starts talking about the kingdom of heaven, he never can talk about it, just as nobody else can really, he can never talk about it in a logical, systematic way. He talks in parables. It is as if so-and-so, this or that. He does that every time. The kingdom of heaven is like a grain of mustard seed or whatever it is. And of course, the person who is just beginning to hear about these things or study them, if he is a somewhat critical-minded person, he says, well, what on earth? The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed. You see the point? So, we must rise out of the tomb, which is all the theologies and the written and spoken teachings as such, which are only verbalizations of the thought forms which rise in us through the experiencing of the reality in consciousness. All these, of course, have form, the thoughts and the words. Form, nevertheless, must not be despised. Its very limitations are the goads that move us to transcendence. Thought itself can serve the purpose of laying bare the fact that all images are but idols. And speech itself can sound the alarm that deflects us from the rape of truth. In trying to parcel up truth in thought and speech, it is like a rape of truth. If thought speech be pure, the human dialogue can lift our eyes to the stars. Then, if it is possible to empty the mind of all its images, its illusions and delusions, the divine dialogue can take place, because the emptied mind, spacious and silent, does not hinder the experiencing of the transcendent. Now, if thought speech be pure, the human dialogue can lift our eyes to the stars. The human dialogue here does not mean the dialogue just between man and man in terms of conversation. When man communes with his fellow man and conveys an inspiring energy which enables the listener to know, to experience the reality, then that is a divine dialogue. And that occurs, of course, with the great spiritual ones in the profoundest meditative states. And you'll notice particularly in the later Upanishads, sometimes called the minor Upanishads. There's nothing minor about them. They are particularly very, very important. The disciple asks a question, and who answers the question? Time and again you will find that one of the aspects of the Trinity, Brahma answers, or Vishnu answers, or Shiva answers, or Narayana answers, and so forth. You see, it's presented in that form. It's the divine dialogue. You find it in the Old Testament. And the Spirit of God moved him, or the angel of the Lord, spoke through Jeremiah or Isaiah or whoever it was, and so forth. That is what it means. Of course, that is what I say. Don't believe a word of what I say. Consider it, but don't believe it, because belief is impotent. So now, if it is possible to empty the mind of all its images. Now, I wouldn't use the word mind again in this context. Remember, this was written 12 years ago. Mind is the archetypal form which expresses the primordial creative energy which acts as a formative power. That is mind. It is the formative power. It is universal. It is transcendent. It cannot be possessed by anybody. I have no mind whatsoever. nor has anybody else a mind unless and until he becomes the perfected Holy One. What we have is psyche. It's a pity in those old days, in India, they never developed the concept of psyche. We have to give the palm to the Greeks there. They brought that word psyche into being, you see. Now, what is this thing which we call the psyche? This transcendent energy, this formative transcendent energy, mind, interacting with matter, the body, and where the human organism is concerned, especially the brain and nervous system, the ductless glands and so on, produces psyche, which is the medium for the expression of what we call our thoughts and feelings, our intellect and emotion and all the rest of it. That is the psychical part of it. The psyche is rooted in matter, in the brain and nervous system, in the ductus glands and so forth. The psyche of each person is as much his own psyche, personally, his own property, as his nose or ear or hand or toenail is his nose or ear or hand. We all talk of my mind, your mind, great mind, little mind, this man's mind, that person's mind. That's all inadequate, misleading talk. No one has mind, just as no one has God or transcendence. Transcendence is embodied in us, but we have to wake up to that fact. That's a different thing, you see. We all say, my God, and all the followers of the different religions say, our God, and they start comparing our God with that fellow's God, and no, yours is not the true God. Ours is the only true God, etc., etc. And look at the horror and disaster and the cruelty and devilry which has been exercised in the name of my God against your God in world history. It exists today. Look at Catholics and Protestants. Look at the Middle East and its activities. Shiites and Sunnis and Israelites and electric lights and and all the rest of the claptrap. Isn't it a terrible horror? So I wouldn't use the word mind again in this context. I would use the word psyche. The psyche is different in each and every person simply because the body, through the evolutionary process, out of the primates, became different. All human bodies are the same in certain ways. Fundamental structure, bones, flesh, blood, skin, hair, nails, etc., etc. That way we are all one and the same. But even they show differences of development, capacity, power, strength, and so on. And the psyche shows a much greater difference between man and man. Much greater difference. Now it is the psyche which is purified, has to be purified. Our thought and feeling, our speech and our action. And it is the psyche which has to be emptied. The psyche is cluttered up with beliefs, convictions, and so on. They are all images. And they are never entirely true to the reality. Our words can be more or less true to reality. If I say a Steinway piano or a Bechstein piano or any other make, and I happen to know how the thing is made, then my using that word, the word is true to the reality of this, that, or the other kind of piano. But all the images that we make, particularly in our interrelationships and with our ideas about things, about reality, truth, and so forth, they are all inadequate, and in the majority of cases, they are quite false. It is this which needs purification. When one empties the psyche of all these images, then mind, this transcendent energy, is able to have free access and free play through your psyche. You see? That is how it happens. And that is the enlightened state. In Buddhism, they use the word mind constantly. They never used a word like psyche, or a word which could have been different from the word mind. They used mind all the way through. I think that's a pity. In this book, actually, there is a whole chapter, Mind, Virtue, Psyche, Karma. That chapter, 16, I think, where I have explained this business about psyche and mind. Now, so when the mind is empty, and you know the great Mahayana philosophy of the void, the mind, the pure mind, is empty, it's void. Void of what? Of all ill. That's all. That is the voidness. Doesn't mean that anybody's mind, anybody's psyche is or brain is vacuous. It's not entirely vacuous. Of course, if by some terrible accident the brain is paralyzed altogether, then of course that's the end. This unclouded vision is shapeless and formless. It is not finite. After the unself-conscious experiencing in which the total mind was wholly silent, the surface mind, you see, I've used inner mind, total mind, surface mind. I should use the word psyche. The psyche again sets up the self-conscious experiencer. I am I, not you, not the not-self, and so forth. The verbalizing faculty intrudes upon the beatitude of silence. Finite images of the imageless infinite materialize the unclouded vision, and thus the word of scripture comes into being. Not that every word of scripture is like that, but too many words of scripture are like that, you see. They hide the reality. The act of conceiving and the act of verbalizing must be as pure as possible. What sullies the purity is our conditioning, the conditioning of the psychophysical organism through two causes. First, natural evolution for over 1,000 millennia. As a matter of fact, over a period of 600 million years. And the cultural conditioning by the particular society in which we are born and bred and educated. The great teachers were those who, to the highest degree possible in their circumstances, had grown free of their conditioning. Now, it is of course possible to be free of conditioning, but within limits. No one can ever be totally free of conditioning. No one, not even the holiest of the holy ones, can be totally free. Because as long as there is a physical body, a psychophysical organism, its inherent limitations will always play their part. That is one of the reasons, perhaps, I say only perhaps, why the prophecies made by the holy ones in several cases just didn't come off. Both Jesus and the Buddha prophesied certain things about the future, and they were quite wrong. Didn't happen that way. You see, because of the conditioning of the organism, and it is the organism that speaks, not the transcendent consciousness. The experiencing of the transcendent consciousness does leave an impress, a very, very powerful impress upon the whole psychophysical organism. And this impress may enable that organism, that person, to get ideas or thoughts which in some degree or other are true to the reality of transcendence. And then he speaks accordingly, as and when he is inspired to speak and is requested to speak, because there are other people who are anxious to know, who wish to know, who wish to live the life which will bring the human organism to perfection. So they speak. You see, now, so it is that the impress made by the experiencing of the transcendent in the Unio Mystica, which enables the organism to speak. You know how Buddhism has presented it and shown that the perfected Holy One, the Sammasambuddha, gives out teaching, but there are the Paccheka Buddhas, who are the silent Buddhas. They do not speak because they just haven't got that kind of development required. It must not be imagined that the great spiritual teachers like Jesus and Buddha and Krishna and Zarathustra and so forth were omniscient in the sense in which people imagine they were omniscient. People imagine that their teacher was a perfect encyclopedia of everything that there is in the cosmos and beyond the cosmos. Nothing of the sort. Most of those holy ones probably couldn't do very well in an O-level examination. If they were omniscient in that sense, that they knew, it is distinctly stated that they knew all about the past, they knew all about the future and so forth. None of the founders of the religions or the very great spiritual teachers knew anything about how the organism evolved over this immense period of hundreds of millions of years. They were completely ignorant of that. And they were ignorant of the limitations imposed by the fact that our brains today contain within themselves the essence of our primordial state, which is represented by the brain stem, our reptilian stage, which is represented by the R-complex, as it is called, which surrounds the stem, by the mammalian stage, which is the limbic, the I've forgotten the other word. It's that limbic means that something which surrounds, you see, and encloses, which represents the mammalian stage when actually the mammals were the first to give birth to live young and to express care and love and affection for the young, and also amongst each other when they were friendly, you see. And we have derived all that. And then we developed the cortex. The cortex developed with the beginning of human of human beings. About 3.5 million years ago, the most evolved primates were able to walk upright. The gorillas and the chimpanzees in Africa, the orangutans and the lemurs in India, you see. And they are our cousins. And how close they are to us in so many respects. Have you seen on TV the way the gorilla is tender? The gorilla's tenderness is unbelievable. If human beings were like that, we would probably never hear of child battering and all that sort of horror. You see, one thing we can do which the animals can't. We can deliberately do wrong. The animals can't deliberate wrong. They cannot store up revenge in their hearts and say, I'll be even with him, I'll get him. They can't do that. They are angelic because they haven't got the power to be devils. We have the power to be devils. But that is a necessary stage in the developmental process. You can't avoid that. So now, this conditioning. We interpret everything with a conditioned brain. Conditioned by natural evolution and by what our society teaches us and imposes upon us. Our beliefs and our values and all the rest criteria are imposed beliefs, values, criteria, and so forth. So the great teachers were people who, for their times, in their circumstances, were free as possible from their conditioning. That is why they took man a step further each time.